Hello everyone and welcome to Margaret Beaufort, Omnibus Edition 7, comprising episodes 19 to 21 and being the very last instalment of her story. So, last time we gaily announced to safe arrival in port the Tudor ship of dynasty. I feel it incumbent on me to remind you once more that no one at the time would have realised that some other pretender from the rightful Royal House of York would not rise up and throw out the usurping Tudor. That's just a bit of slightly out-of-date Rose's trash talk, by the way, up York and all that, in a deeply impartial, historically accurate way, of course. We've seen how Margaret exercised great influence over her son and played a significant role at court, that she was a conduit to the king for petitioners, though probably without getting in the way of the queen's role, and that part of the reason for this was not simply her experience, knowledge, and personal bond with her son, but because as a family member without political ambitions, she was someone Henry could trust with power without fear. And as you may know if you have followed Henry's career, in his later years he would grow increasingly suspicious and even despotic. Margaret was very much prepared and willing to meet her son's expectations. In many of her dealings, she saw herself as the king's agent. This becomes even more pronounced in the last decade of Margaret's life, when she becomes something approaching a regional satrap, in the style of a mini-version of Richard of Gloucester under his brother Edward IV. Her domain was not to be in the north, but the beating heart of England, which, as of course you are no doubt fully aware, is the East Midlands. From some point in 1499, Margaret began to spend more and more time at Colley Weston in Northamptonshire, from where she established a sort of mini court. Colley Weston, as it happens, is not a million miles from where my mother lives, which I appreciate it's unlikely to be why Margaret moved there, but this has allowed me to go and look for her palace. I think I'm correct in saying there's pretty much nothing left above ground, which is a shame, and which falls into the sick transit and so on category, because Margaret spent even more on Colley Weston Palace than Kevin's sheepskin jacket. She spent an absolute packet. I'd have liked to have seen it. In that part of the world, roofs often traditionally used split local stone rather than slate or thatch, and it's very attractive. The local stone is astounding, a deep iron-stain yellow. Anyway, in the process, Colley Weston was transformed from an attractive 15th-century manor house into a palace and a centre of administration and business. By 1506, it contained a chapel, of course, with a gallery that connected that chapel to Margaret's own chambers. There was the business and entertainment end in common with any great magnate and landowner, the great hall and parlour, as we discussed in the episode on Woking Palace. But also, there was a presence chamber more in keeping with royalty, and various rooms allocated to her household. It was a place of education also, not just with a library, though there was one of those, but a chamber equipped with desks for the kiddywinks. There was a section for almsfolk, their own area with a kitchen yard and a common hall, garden and running water. There were two clockhouses and, rather more grimly, a prison block to boot. There was an opportunity for fun in the development too, in the sense that Margaret took personal interest in the laying out and refurbishment of extensive gardens for pleasure, but also for produce, herbs, fruit, veggies, and so on. Colley Weston became a major centre with a great and powerful household. It was a carefully ordered regime, projecting pomp, highly visual charity. It was also an engine for fulfilling Margaret's role as one of the magnates of the land. There is a description of Margaret's household by one Henry Parker, in which he states that her estate at Colley Weston employed 400 people, which is an enormous number. The real number may be nearer 230 long-term staff, but either way, this is an impressive household from which she administered her lands, together with her own working council. Many of these household members would have worn the Beaufort livery of blue and silver with the Beaufort portcullis. Within this household, Margaret fulfilled her obligations. Religious, administrative, charitable. But her most constant companions would have been her female attendants. Some of their names, reachers, such as Perrot, the Frenchwoman, Edith Fowler, and Lady Jane Guildford. Margaret's household, as you might expect, was closely managed. Her ordinances were read out to the household 4 times a year, which I can imagine were fun occasions, no doubt, a time to put your feet up and enjoy a cream bun. Margaret was not one for leaving things to chance or to tolerate inefficiency. Margaret's council was staffed by impressive and experienced administrators, and particularly so in legal matters. Now look, every major landowner of the time had the need for good lawyers to defend their lands from legal predators and, frankly, to carry out a bit of legalised predation to build their own lands. And Margaret, it has to be said, was no shrinking violet in this regard. But also, these councillors were part of Margaret's almost conciliar power, devolved from her royal son. Remarkably, Margaret established and ran her own equity court. So by equity, I mean a court like Star Chamber, unencumbered with the need to pay attention to common law. Judgment by Margaret and her judges to establish and implement what they considered equitable. This court was not just a baronial court, ruling on matters such as errant sheep, badly maintained fences and unwisely situated manure heaps. The scope of Margaret's court was really quite broad, almost equivalent to regional councils like those of the North or of Wales. She equipped the council with its own council house, and as mentioned, with its very own prison. On occasion, she wrote to civic authorities as far afield as Coventry on behalf of an aggrieved citizen, and she did so in the King's name. Her court investigated cases of treasonable intent and even suits specifically delegated from the Royal Council itself. Her power and authority were such that she even intervened in ecclesiastical cases. There's an intriguing case about a priest, one John Stokesley, who is accused, among other things, of baptising a cat. Now, even the most trendy, pump-wearing, guitar-toting vicar, I think, might balk at that these days, even in the increasingly popular animal services I think were going on before the pandemic. On further investigation, it seems that Stokesley was accused thereby of finding treasure by magical means. Not quite sure how that works. And it was part of a whole tranche of accusations against the lad, including witchcraft, heresy, perjury, theft, and adultery. But Stokesley was exonerated. Very probably he'd simply got involved in a spat about who was to be president of Magdalen College, and the accusations were a cunning ploy to remove a political opponent, something to bear in mind should I apply for some major post, such as parish councillor or village litter monitor or some such. Not even Jackie Weaver, the now famous leader of Handford Parish Council, could cope with cat baptism accusations, I suspect. Anyway, Stokesley was exonerated and went on to a happy career as Bishop of London and persecutor of Protestant heretics under Henry VIII. Margaret then occupied an exceptional place as a woman in regional politics as she had at court. For all the world, she was like a male, powerful magnate with semi-regal powers. In other ways, she fulfilled more traditional roles in local politics and communities as a powerful landowner, in both positive and more negative ways. She was a voracious pursuer of her rights, for example, or what she considered to be her rights, and while that might seem particularly associated with male landowners, women often got very much involved in the daily cut and thrust of local decision-making and estate management and fighting off legal challenges, or indeed pursuing legal challenges on other landowners. Certainly, we've seen Margaret Paston very much in that role through the Paston letters. As I say, this has negative as well as positive aspects. So, for example, Margaret vigorously pursued the exploitation of her estates, and while I think it's fair to say that Margaret had a very strong sense of obligation to her tenants, when she thought it necessary, she could be harsh and ton of bricks-like. One example is her removal of a walk mill at one of her estates in Cumbria for fear of damage to the fish stocks. She was firm in encouraging her bailiffs to impose fines from the manorial courts, leading to violent riot on at least one occasion amongst her villagers. The construction of a new brick prison in Kendal confirmed that however generous Margaret might be on occasion, she was not to be crossed. She was pretty ruthless as a landowner and estate manager. She employed one of her husband Thomas Stanley's estate managers in Kendal, as it happens, William Wall. Wall appears to have been either a forgiving or an inefficient manager, with some annuities and obligations left uncollected, which in Margaret's view would never do. So, in 1501, Margaret fired him. In order to do so, interestingly, without offending her husband Stanley, she engaged in a bit of subterfuge with her son, you know, the King of England and Line of Justice, that one. And she got him to order that she could give a job only to those employed in the name of Henry Duke of York. "This," she wrote to Henry, "shall be a good excuse for me to my lord and husband," i.e. a good excuse for firing William Wall. "Sorry, hub, wasn't my fault. The king wills it." Nothing like working your contacts, I guess. In her mission to maximise her revenue, she searched her feudal rights, one of which was in wardship. So many wards did she have at one stage that it was rumoured that she had a special building constructed in which to house them all. She exploited opportunities to make justice pay by holding special courts, such as in Boston in 1507, and her agents were in constant attendance at county sessions to keep an eye on things. Her administration was highly centralised and efficient, so while being concentrated around her council in Colley Weston, she showed excellent local knowledge. For example, in 1495, she brought an action at common law against a tenant who tried to get away with not paying a feudal due on his initial occupation and inheritance of the land. She knew what was going on. Her eyes were hawk-like. They made Sauron's eye look dim, distant, and slightly damp. She was unusually successful, therefore, in her aim of maximising revenue. Her Lincolnshire estates, for example, had yielded £266 in 1493. By 1502, she'd increased that to £350, and by 1505, to £399. It's a pretty relentless and significant rise. None of this made her or her agents popular, as you can imagine. Her records complain of threats and assaults on her agents, sometimes reaching levels so that business remained undone. On the other side of the story, though, Margaret very much believed in her responsibilities towards the communities of which she was part, in a practical sense of improving their economic life, as well as the more traditional responsibilities of charity. A good example, then, was in her connections with Cambridge. Now, as you may know, town and gown relationships were not always very harmonious in days medieval, no more in Oxford than in Cambridge. Margaret was determined to use her authority and influence to bring the parties together and get issues resolved and sorted out. So she brought both of the parties to Colley Weston to thrash things out, the result being a detailed composition in 1503 laying out the issues and their agreed resolution between town and gown. An even better example would be Boston in Lincolnshire. Boston had fallen on hard times, largely because the harbour there was steadily silting up, so merchants were leaving the town, tenements were falling into decay. Margaret had many contacts in the town, many connections and responsibilities, and she felt a debt of honour towards the town, joining their religious guilds, for example. So, she invested in the town, repairing tenements, building water defences. In 1500, she supported a project to improve the condition of the harbour. Now, it's worth noting that Margaret would benefit from increased rents if Boston bloomed, so it's not entirely altruistic by any means. It's more like Tom Lehrer's old dope peddler doing well by doing good. But equally, a quick look down the list of Margaret's activities would convince you that this is someone who took her social and religious responsibilities very seriously indeed. And another example was in the college at the Lincolnshire village of Tattershall, where Margaret had family links through the Wells family. Margaret rather took the college in hand, creating new statutes, reforming the structure, and appointing a new post of warden, becoming the college's patron and fighting its corner. I use this as an example to finish because it combines the things that really made Margaret tick: her commitment and loyalty to her widely extended family, to piety and religion, and to education. One of the things I suspect people associate with Margaret is a very deep and possibly rather austere piety. There are a couple of things which create this impression, both of which we have discussed before. There are the portraits of her that survive, and they present Margaret as she wanted to be remembered, dressed in religious clothing, in prayer, with her piety therefore full at the forefront. Although in the images, there are also multiple symbols of her wealth, status, and dynasty, lest we forget, and remind us who she was and just quite how important she was. But it's the piety that gets the lead billing. And then there is John Fisher's sermon at her funeral, which emphasised her piety and the qualities of her mind and character, which pervades most of the stories of the time in which she was involved and has been hugely influential in the way she's seen. After all, there were no other written narratives to compete with it. Now, John Fisher and Margaret shared a close relationship. They had met at Greenwich in 1494 at court. Fisher was 20 years at least junior to Margaret. The son of a merchant at Beverley in Yorkshire, he'd become a priest at Northallerton before coming back down south to his alma mater at Cambridge, where he'd been offered the post of senior proctor. So he came to Margaret's notice because Fisher's intelligence and talents had made a name for himself. And when he came to court on the business of his proctorship, Margaret resolved and indeed succeeded in snapping him up and signing him up for her household. Before long, he became her chaplain and her confessor, and by the time of Margaret's death, they'd become firm friends. It was a relationship of some depth of feeling. Fisher became Bishop of Rochester, in which post, incidentally, he was to be executed by Henry VIII, and it was to Fisher that Margaret confirmed her vow of chastity after her husband Thomas Stanley died, with these words: "I vow to you, my Lord of Rochester, to whom I am and have been, since the first time I saw you admitted, very determined to owe my obedience." Margaret confided in Fisher, and in return, Fisher learned from Margaret, from someone more experienced than him in the ways of patronage and advancing his career. We might also note that having a role in Margaret's household did not mean he was taken away from Cambridge. Indeed, his work and success there also landed him a job as Vice-Chancellor of the university, which would later become a post for life. In that process, though, Margaret's patronage of Fisher did his career no harm whatsoever, and indeed landed him a couple of extra posts. The rules governing recruitment procedures were not rigorous in the 15th century. I mention how close this relationship was because we need to take his testimony with just a tiny wee pinch of salt, for four reasons, really. Firstly, because it will be important later when we get to Margaret's educational legacy. Secondly, they're mates. He's going to put the best possible gloss on her life, isn't he? Thirdly, the sermon was at a funeral, which is traditionally not the occasion to do a hatchet job. But fourthly, because you know what preachers are like. They have to preach, probably even if they're alone in the forest alongside a fallen tree. And Fisher was using Margaret as an example, or maybe A cattle prod might be a better word. A cattle prod with which to poke his audience through the gate into the field of holiness, away from the field of hooliness. So, it is possible he exaggerated just a tiny wee bit. And he certainly did lay it on with a trowel. According to Fisher, her day started at 5 o'clock in the morning with morning prayers and matins with her household ladies. And then a little more matins in her closet with the chaplain. And then 4 or 5 masses during the day, all spent on her knees. Fisher went further, emphasising Margaret's temperance. She never had dinner, still held around 11 in the morning at this time, by the way, and she frequently fasted. And then the pièce de résistance. She had her shirts and girdles of hair, which when she was in health every week, she failed not certain days to wear sometime. Well, that certainly sounds devout. Her piety was not restricted to her relationship with Fisher, though. Her chapel played a major role within her household and included many members of staff. One of them in particular was Henry Hornby, who served as Margaret's secretary, Dean of Chapel, and after 1504 as her Chancellor. A Lincolnshire lad, Hornby also had connections with Cambridge University. He organised the payment for mass books and primers from London printers, and incidentally, Margaret was an important patron for printers. Even Fisher noted that she had divers books in French wherewith she could occupy herself when she was weary of prayer. She patronised William Caxton when he opened his shop, so much so that he dedicated 2 books to her. She also patronised another printer, Winken de Worde, and 5 of the books he printed had dedications to Margaret. Now, many of these books were devotional, such as The Ladder of Perfection, a work of mystic theology that described the soul's journey of contemplation. And in this, Margaret was part of a strong tradition at the time of devotional literature. However, it must be said also that Margaret was not averse to some raunchy French novels, those French, really, and was the inspiration behind Caxton's translation and printing of the French romance Blanchardine and Eglantine. I should probably withdraw the word raunchy, by the way, and substitute, let's say, popular. Margaret was also part of the flavour of the day, which was setting many devotions around particular cults. So Margaret had a particular devotion to the holy name of Jesus. In fact, she was recognised as the patron of the feast associated with it, and manuscripts associated with the order of service were dedicated to her. She was a very visible patron of the church in such ways, above and beyond the normal run of the dedications and bequests that she made to colleges, chantries, fraternities and so on. She was equally visible in taking part in public ceremonies, of ministering to the poor with her own hand, and she had a strong sense of moral responsibility towards her servants, establishing almshouses at all of her properties, as well as at Westminster, for example, where she set up an almshouse for 13 women. She visited religious houses, even getting special dispensation to do so for closed orders. She visited almshouses to dispense food and medicine and talk to the inmates. So I think we have a pretty clear idea of a very devout person indeed, for whom piety formed a framework for her life, her social and moral obligations. Her daily routine also speaks of a highly structured life. It fits with the supreme efficiency and professionalism with which she ran her estate, and of an iron will, discipline and self-control. This is Margaret for you, a woman who spent hours on her knees in prayer every day while suffering in later life from very painful arthritis, and for whom such activities must have demanded iron determination. As Fisher noted, "These merciful and liberal hands to endure the most painful cramps, so grievously vexing her and compelling her to cry out." Having said all that, I'm now going to leaven the bread just a tiny wee bit, if you don't mind. First of all, we do have information from another source in her household, Henry Parker, about her daily routine. Here is Henry also extolling his mistress. "Her Grace was every morning in chapel betwixt 6 and 7 of the clock, and daily said matins of the day with one of her chaplains. And that said, from 7 till it was 11 of the clock, as soon as one priest had said Mass in her sight, another began. One time in a day she was confessed, then going to dinner. How honourably she was served. I think few kings better. Her condition, always at the beginning for her dinner, being to be joyous, and hear those tales which were honest, to make her merry. In the midst of her dinner, either her Amna or I read some virtuous tale unto her of the life of Christ or such like. The latter end of her dinner again, she was disposed to talk with the bishop or with her chancellor, which sat at her board, of some godly matter. I think in general we can agree that the flavour is very much in the Fisher mode. Though also, I might point out that when Fisher claimed Margaret never had dinner, he was clearly exaggerating for effect. And it's not surprising. Dinner was an important occasion for a lord to connect with their household. It would have been very surprising if Margaret had dispensed with it. As you may know, if you are a History of England member and have listened to the biography podcast I did of Fisher, he also was praised for keeping a good table. Being pious and generous with the nosh were not mutually exclusive. While I'm on it, although her reputation was for her austerity, she was conscious of the importance of regular festivities in the round of religious feasts. So, in Christmas 1505, for example, Margaret engaged an abbot of Misrule to oversee the celebrations, including morris dancers and players. It was also a time for the distribution of alms and goodies for all. One further point to make is that, extreme as all this sounds to the modern ear, and as keen as Fisher was to use Margaret as a model, it's not actually that unusual for great aristocratic women of the time. In fact, Margaret in many ways conformed to a model, albeit in quite a strong form. I think we have already been through Cecily of York's day, a matriarch with many similarities to Margaret, and her day equally was filled with masses and devotional literature, and her life marked by public charitable activities. Margaret of York, too, was known for her good works and also a patron of Caxton. In Margaret's wider cultural interests, Margaret also shared those of many of her contemporaries. So Juliana Berners, prioress of Sopwell, wrote treatises on hawking, hunting, fishing and heraldry. Lady Hungerford used Latin sources to increase her own awareness of her own part and participation in worship, as did Margaret with her devotional literature. The number of books associated with Margaret is certainly impressive, but even then, far fewer than the likes of Louise of Savoy or Margaret of Navarre. Basically, it's pretty much without dispute that piety and a sense of moral obligation was central to Margaret's worldview, and she was particularly rigorous in carrying it out. It's also clear that in this she had many examples of contemporaries and peers around her to emulate. The same applies, in a sense, to her support for education. It was not new in Margaret's time. It had become an established tradition. Famously, of course, Henry VI had been responsible for founding many educational institutions, so Eton, King's College Cambridge, and All Souls Oxford. Margaret of Anjou had founded Queen's College in 1448. But while she may not have broken a mould, Margaret was to be exceptional in the level of her support to her most local university town, Cambridge. Though she also retained an interest in Oxford, her first foray into benefaction was to endow two professorships, the modern Lady Margaret professorships, one at Oxford and one at Cambridge. But her main interest was probably always going to head towards Cambridge. She was already involved, as we heard last time, knocking heads together to get issues resolved between town and gown in her composition of 1503. And it was the University of John Fisher, her confidant and confessor, and his guidance and information certainly led her there. Henry VI had also taken an interest, as it happens, in a college called God's House, which had been founded in 1439 by a man called William Bingham. And John Fisher brought the rather impoverished college to her attention. By 1505, she had applied for and been granted a licence to expand and rename the college, and so it became Christ's College. Interestingly, the devotional trend generally was towards a focus on Christ, and by this time Jesus College as a name was already taken, leaving Christ's as the best next option. Now, Margaret's fingerprints are all over the endowment and development of Christ's College, Cambridge. This was her project, and she would ensure it was effectively controlled and effectively carried out. She was no arm's-length philanthropist providing the financing and nothing more. She was allocated a set of rooms for her use at the college because she now visited the town regularly, and one of her suites of four rooms overlooked the chapel, so that Margaret could pray in private there. Nor was Margaret shy about her patronage. Evidence of the Beaufort role is all over the place, including a window in the chapel and the Beaufort arms and motto, "Souvent me souviens," I often remember, over the master's lodge. Her patronage continued with the bequest of a silver cup, the Beaufort cup, which still survives there. She left the college many pieces of plate and books in her will, and she endowed the college with the Abbey of St. Mary de Pratist in Norfolk. She purchased other estates for them, including the manors of Moulton and Royden, Cambridgeshire, which transformed the wealth of the previously poverty-stricken God's House, and her accounting was meticulous and thorough. She gave substantial support and involvement on building works between 1505 and 1509, including the princely sum for the time of 1625 quid. Again, the involvement and the oversight is detailed and practical. The statutes that were delivered to the master in 1506 include opening words written in Margaret's own hand. The things that were most important to Margaret come across, such as the declaration that there are three things that we desire all the fellows of the college to care for above all things, namely the worship of God, the increase of the faith, and probity of morals. There's a legend that when visiting one day, Margaret saw the dean punishing one of his students, and she leant out of the window and cried, "Gently, gently." No idea if that's really true or a bit of a legend, but it's interesting colour if true, supporting the idea that she was a sympathetic patron. At the same time, she did not forget her family. Prayers were to be said for the souls of members of her family and colleagues, including Edmund Tudor, the father of her son. Again, three aspects of things that drove Margaret are in evidence: social responsibility, piety, and family. While Christ's College was the major foundation made within her lifetime, Fisher also bent her ear about making another bequest to refound the Hospital of St. John the Evangelist as a college of the university. Margaret and Fisher started work on this in 1508, but it was complicated and therefore wasn't completed until 1511, after Margaret's death, pushed through by Fisher. The colleges of Christ's and St. John's are lasting legacies of Margaret's life and priorities. Okay, last time we spoke of the political life of Margaret, I believe we celebrated the betrothal by proxy of Prince Arthur to Catherine of Aragon, a particularly significant marriage. Through this, the Tudors reached the port of legitimacy and strode out onto the sunny uplands of international confidence. A major royal house had decided that, yes, they could send their daughter to England, that, yes, they would not end up having her throat cut by some obscure claimant to the throne from England's largest county. He must have been like finally being able to join the EU after the humiliation of de Gaulle's "non" in 1963 and 7. Was that a wise analogy, I wonder? Answers on a postcard. Anyway, the triumph was further cemented in November 1501 when Catherine of Aragon's slippered foot met the uncultured soil of England, and when she was welcomed to a London that had most firmly pushed the boat out to welcome her. On the 14th of November they were married, and watching from a discreet location was the terrible trio, Queen Elizabeth, King Henry, and his mum. They apparently, and I quote, stood secretly in a closet. And while I realise the word closet has shifted in its meaning, I cannot get the image of King Henry VII, Queen Elizabeth of York, and Lady Margaret Beaufort, having found themselves lost in the palace, taking a wrong turn and finding themselves in a broom cupboard by mistake, hoping no one had noticed. I apologise, I realise this is unprofessional. Anyway, you'll be unsurprised to hear that Arthur's granny turned on the waterworks. She had form, after all. That night, of course, Arthur and Catherine were put to bed for one of the most controversial wedding nights ever. We'll leave that one, though. I think it's been covered. As far as Margaret is concerned, we do not know what she thought of Catherine, but the likelihood has got to be she was as delighted and keen to make her welcome as everyone else. Something of a wrinkle is that a number of Margaret's household members transferred over to Catherine's household. The best interpretation is that this is because they were experienced and knowledgeable and trustworthy. A more cynical person might say that it was because Margaret was as keen to have a hand in Catherine's affairs and know what was going on as she was in Queen Elizabeth's affairs. After several days of revelry, including some at Margaret's home at Cold Harbour House in London, by December, Arthur and Catherine had been packed off to Shropshire to start their own household at lovely Ludlow. In 1502, interestingly, Margaret went into the debt collection business, travelling over to France to try to wring money out of Louis XII. Now, this was not a new debt. In 1424, yes, that's 1424, Jean, the Count of Angoulême, had been taken hostage by Thomas, Duke of Clarence. In 1421, the Count's custody had passed to Clarence's widow, and then to the children of her first Beaufort marriage. Jean was released on parole in 1445, but the House of Orléans still owed money to the Beauforts, the little tinkers, and the debt was inherited by Margaret Beaufort in 1482. I mean, what does this mean for a reading of Margaret's mentality, I wonder, that she still wanted to collect this old, old debt, which probably had mould on it by now? You could, I guess, paint it as a strong belief in right and wrong, in a determination to render unto Margaret that which was Margaret's, similar to her pursuit of rights in her management of estates in England. Or you might just add it to the avaricious pile, or even obsessively focused on dotting I's and crossing T's pile. Or all of the above, maybe. Louis, of course, said, "Gosh, you're quite right," and then did absolutely zip. The matter was unresolved on Margaret's death. You might say that at the start of 1502, Margaret's fortunes had hit an absolute high. Her family were legit, heir and a spare in situ, accepted by Spain, no less, mariage, next generation, presumably well on the production line. The next 12 months were to demonstrate that the obsession with the Wheel of Fortune of this time was sadly very well founded. So from Ludlow, news first arrived that there was a plague. Then there came news that Catherine had caught it but recovered, which Arthur then caught and did not recover. By the 2nd of April 1502, Henry and Elizabeth's eldest son was dead. And as you can imagine, they were devastated. And although her response is not recorded, you can guess Margaret was too. It was not long before Queen Elizabeth was pregnant again, but on the 2nd of February 1503, after giving birth to a baby girl, Elizabeth sickened and Elizabeth died. And 7 days later, her newborn followed to her to the grave. Deaths continued. In August of that year, Reginald Bray, Margaret's right-hand man for so many years, also died and was buried in St George's Chapel in Windsor, which he'd helped build, as it happens. And then in July 1504, her husband Thomas Stanley died. Margaret was not with him at the time, but at Colley Weston. She, of course, did the right thing, as you would expect, and the whole household went into mourning. No doubt Margaret regretted his passing. There certainly seems to have been no animosity in their relationship, but equally was clearly a marriage of convenience, which had served its purpose, and Margaret had new priorities now and had done so for a while. Incidentally, Stanley's death made her very rich indeed, and to be fair, she'd not been short of a bob or two before that either. But you might remember that Margaret had received only a third to two-thirds of her marriage portion under the agreement they'd made when Margaret was declared to be a femme sole. Now, she received both the kit and she also received the caboodle. As a result, her income was boosted by £3,000, which was enough in itself to keep three peers of the realm going. Margaret had a decision to make now then. Should she remarry? She was around 60, and I suspect, though I don't know, that this was a decision that took her less than a nanosecond to come to. Instead, she reaffirmed her vows with Bishop Fisher to promise from henceforth the chastity of my body. That is, never to use my body having actual knowledge of man after the common usage in matrimony. Now, common usage in matrimony, of course, is an engagingly romantic turn of phrase that everyone ought to use at their wedding reception. But of course, to Margaret, dedicating her body to God was very much a sacred trust, and it seems entirely unsurprising that she reconfirmed the vows that she had made so many years before. By 1505, Margaret was spending more time close to London than she was at Colley Weston, so that she could be near court. In 1506, this was fortunate, and allowed her to play a role in an unexpected party, the visit of Philip and Juana of Castile. It's a curious little incident. So the pair, King and Queen of Castile, were actually forced to land in Dorset by bad weather, and Henry immediately seized on it, in the milk of human kindness, as a business opportunity, and had them brought tout suite to London. While he had the lad at his mercy, he persuaded Philip to extradite one of the de la Poules to England, which he duly did, as it happens. Now, Queen Juana was the monarch here in her own right, not Philip, her husband, but the pair of them were badly estranged. Juana would in fact be described as mad, and Philip would confine her. And during his visit, he did his very best to keep her away from proceedings and spent a great deal of effort telling everyone just how crazy she was. The English people she met seemed to think she was perfectly fine, as it happens. However, Juana was also Catherine of Aragon's sister, as luck would have it, and Henry was not keen for them to meet because, quite frankly, poor Catherine had been very shabbily treated by Henry after Arthur's death, one of Henry's less attractive episodes. However, it was hardly possible to keep them apart when Philip and Juana visited Richmond Palace, an event at which Margaret played centre role. The arrangements included a meeting with Catherine in front of the whole court, but for literally minutes, before Juana was whipped away and before Catherine could complain of her treatment. If Margaret objected to this charade, we hear nothing of it. The abiding impression of Margaret was that she had no compunction about doing that which needed to be done. From 1507, Margaret became aware that her son's health was also failing. She was, of course, desperately keen to be near to him, so much so that makeshift lodgings were constructed for her servants at Richmond Palace. By 1509, he was clearly on his last legs, in clog-popping territory, and on the 21st of April he heard his last mass. In his final will, dictated as he lay dying, Henry specified that he should be buried in his dramatic new chapel at Westminster Abbey. I understand he also allocated money to enable 10,000 prayers to be said for his soul, which suggests there were one or two skeletons in the cupboard that he was worried about. On top of the executors of his will was, of course, his most trusted and thoroughly efficient right-hand man, Margaret. But by this time, Margaret herself was not well either, but the council appointed by Henry to manage the kingdom until the coronation of the new king, Henry VIII, also had at the top of it the murder of the late said king. Henry also had a few months to go before his 18th birthday, so for a short while, Margaret was, at last, effectively the Queen of England, or at least the unofficial regent of England. For the short period of her control, she spent most of it designing the council to serve Henry by stuffing it with her favourites, such as, you may not be shocked to hear, John Fisher. Fancy. But another was to order the arrest of Henry VII's trusted servants, Empsom and Dudley, and her grandson would later have them executed. I have always thought this an act of political ingratitude. Both of them had merely been following their boss's orders in exacting finance from his overmighty subjects. They would pay the price to maintain Henry VII's good name and give a positive start to the new king's reign. Anyway, again, Margaret had little compunction in doing what was necessary, and her grandson, of course, would make something of a habit of executing loyal and efficient servants. Margaret was herself now on her last legs, but had time to see Henry marry Catherine, and for the pair of them to marry in all joyfulness and hope of a fresh new reign. But by May, she was seriously ill. Henry Parker suggested she was brought to the final crisis by eating a dodgy cygnet, which made her very sick. Whatever the cause, on the 29th of June 1509, Margaret Beaufort breathed her last at the deanery of the Abbey of Westminster, apparently at the exact same time as the host was being raised by the bishop. She would be buried near her beloved son. Where else, you would have to say. So that's it then, gentle listeners. We have arrived at the end of Margaret's story. What do we think? Well, it's interesting. I can understand why there is a surprisingly strong tendency for people to take a ginner. Because I suppose that's what it's like with powerful people. They're a bit in your face, by and large, and therefore likely to rub people up the wrong way. If I was to pick a single word, I think I would choose formidable. This is someone with a pretty clear view of what she wanted and expected, and with a set, traditional, and quite inflexible world view. And there were undeniably negatives to that. She was pretty merciless in the pursuit of her objectives when she'd gained control of her life. She pursued her rights hard, she extracted every penny she could from her estates, she had a clear view of what was hers. She was deeply determined and tenacious. How else could she have survived the vicissitudes of the first 50 years of her life, which is a really extraordinary story? Her singleness of purpose was pretty scary, and in her relationship with her son, maybe worryingly extreme. But surely she is worthy of respect and awe more than anything. And not just in overcoming the obstacles that she faced, including becoming a mother at the age of 13, and in a pretty hostile world. She was driven by thoroughly 15th century aristocratic virtues, it seems to me, a complete belief in what her status and dynasty entitled her to, but equally a full acceptance of the responsibilities that also gave her. The responsibility to look after the interests of her extended family, which she did constantly, to use her status and resources to support the communities of which she was part, to give generously to the poor, and leave a long-standing legacy to future generations. Above all, she was frighteningly practical and driven. It's interesting to reflect, I think, that her right to the throne was stronger than her son's. I think she was rather conscious of that. It's very revealing that in her will, she consistently referred to herself as princess. It's entirely typical of her commitment to her son that she did not advance her claim, and yet, if she had managed by some hook or by crook to become the Queen of England, I can't doubt she'd have had all the qualities, attractive and unattractive, to have made her as impressive a monarch as England had ever had. So, they think it's all over, and indeed, it is now. I hope you've enjoyed the story of Margaret. Next, we will move on to a character I imagine will be less attractive, that of John Hawkwood. But hey, it will enable us to wallow in the world of medieval Italy and the Condottieri, and surely that is a fun prospect. Oh, and in medieval Essex, of course, so we can have a bit of Towie too, if you know what that means. In the meantime then, everyone, good luck and have a great week.